Ways and Means. Today's agenda is House Bill 5010, Construction Contractors Board Budget Request. Let me just say that probably not as many acronyms in the Construction Contractors Board other than CCB. And I didn't buy it the other day, but I'll buy it today. I already owe 50 cents.
I'll go halvesies with you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Two bits.
Acronym PIG belongs to the American Cancer Society, and I appreciate Representative Johnson's rather substantial enforcement efforts in making sure that those folks reap the maximum rewards from anybody who wants to use acronyms in the subcommittee. Today we're represented from the Legislative Fiscal Office by Adrian Sexton, and our assistant committee assistant from down at the office, Legislative Fiscal, is Karen Segrist. With that, let's proceed with 5010. And we're going to hear first from Legislative Fiscal Office. Why don't we do that and have you just tell us where we're at.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson. Excuse me if my voice gives out.
You don't need to speak really, really loud because we're just a subcommittee of the subcommittee this morning.
That's true. But my mother always told me my voice carried, so I'll just sort of do what I usually do.
What were you screaming for when she told you that?
Probably something my brother did. I don't know. First of all, I want to just confirm with the committee members that you received from me and have inserted it, or your staff have inserted into your packet a couple of replacement pages. One was my own analysis, and the second one had to do with the the budget notes, and I made some corrections after review with the agency, so I just want to be sure that you have those. And I delivered those to your office yesterday with a little pink slip attached. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, I received my pink slip.
You got your pink slip. And if you don't have it, I will give you a complete new packet, and then that will give you all the current stuff. Lost Representative.
Please.
I will continue. Construction Contractors Board, Senator Devlin, just want to confirm that your staff did receive and provided to you the updates. Thank you. House Bill 5010 is their budget bill, and the Construction Contractors Board, I think most of you are familiar with it. This is an agency that's been around for a while. It had been called the Builders Board at one time, and it was originally created to provide consumer protection and continues to do that today. But its role has been expanded over the course of its lifetime. But its principal requirements are that it is to protect the public's interest relating to improvements to real property. And it does that through a variety of programs, one of which is the regulation of construction contractors. And coupled with the protection of the public's interest in that is that the agency also seeks to promote a competitive business environment. They license individuals and businesses engaged in construction and construction-related activities, which are things like lead-based paint, contractors, people who work with the hazardous materials. Home inspectors have been added to that list as well. They also provide education programs for both consumers and contractors. That includes outreach and public forums such as home shows and meetings with interested groups like senior citizens and so forth. They also have a large dispute resolution program, and that is to resolve issues between parties to construction activities. That includes the contractors and the clients, the customers. It also includes contractors and material suppliers and the employees of contractors. They also enforce laws relating to contractor licensing and business practices, and they do that in cooperation with the Department of Justice and local law enforcement agencies. The governor's balanced budget for the Construction Contractors Board for 0305 is all other funds. It's $12,070,329 with 60.75 FTE. The other funds are all license fees, fines and forfeitures, and then there's some other sales income. The agency's budget also the fines and forfeitures, civil penalties, are divided between the agency at 20%, and then 80% of those funds go to the general fund. My third slide just shows the revenue sources and the relative dynamic of those, where the license and related fees is over 99% of their revenue stream. Their expenditures by program area, the wheel there starting at 12 o'clock and going clockwise, starts with the administrative costs, licensing, dispute resolution, hearings panel costs. The agency, when the central hearing panel was created through House Bill 2525 two sessions ago, its hearing unit was moved to the central hearing panel at the employment department. So the agency does continue to have expenditures associated with their contested case hearings, but it's via the central hearing panel. Then their education program and their enforcement unit. Budget drivers for the Construction Contractors Board. Principally coming from economic conditions, including new influences here over the last couple of years, costs of insurance and financial responsibility bonds, which each contractor has to post a notice of insurance and financial responsibility with the agency, and there have been some issues about the availability or the costs of those items, which do affect the construction industry at this point. The other economic conditions, as you are well aware, simply if people don't have jobs, don't have money to do new construction or remodeling, it seriously affects this agency, which you'll see in my analysis later, has yielded a revenue shortfall for them this past biennium. It's also driven by the number of complaints filed by individuals and others who are eligible to do so. They also are subject, as all other agencies, to the inflation on the essential services and state government service charges as a state agency. Any questions on those items?
Yeah, I'm going to come back and ask just a couple of questions, if I may. The fines and forfeitures are split 20% to the agency and 80% to the general fund. Is that
correct?
Right? Do we know the amount amongst that $12 million that represents the 20% CCB?
Mr. Chair, off the top of my head, I believe the amount for the biennium to go to the general fund is
$400,000. $400,000. So $100,000 would be coming back to Construction Contractor Board?
I believe it's more like
$120,000 to $500,000. Well, 80-20? Before 80 and 120?
100% of the $400,000 would stay with the CCB.
So the total amount of the fines and forfeitures is
$400,000? Correct.
Okay. So $400,000 and fines and forfeitures total.
Okay. $120,000 at the agency, yes.
And then relative to back on page one of your presentation, Construction Contractors Board, the enforcement of laws for contractor licensing and business practices. Do we have a breakdown of what percentage of their time is expended towards contractor licensure versus business practices? I'd like to know, with regard to resolution disputes, the experience, history, and satisfaction with regard to the hearings panel. And then we'll talk about education and visit about how much of that is online, how much of that can be presented online and through video and distant conferencing, because you know, quite honestly, these folks driving their pickups to Salem or wherever they have to be trained is going to be a bigger and bigger and bigger item all the time as we're talking here.
Mr. Chair, would you like the agency to elaborate on those particular points when they?
I think so. I'd rather than nail you for them, and then we can come back on about page four of your presentation, Adrian, and I'd like to just go through and talk about specifically those percentages and the amounts that are expended in the in each of the program areas, and we'll visit on that.
All right. Okay. Mr. Chair, the agency did provide in the materials in their budget presentation book the nature of the activities that are associated with each of those broad categories.
Okay. With that, thank you very much, Adrian.
Okay. Two other things.
I'm going to hit your other pages that have been amended then. Is that right?
Thank you. That's right, Mr. Chair. And that is my analysis of the governor's budget. As I mentioned earlier, the budget environment for this agency is such that they have continually been working this interim to work with their revenue shortfall, and they have kept me apprised of the review that they've been doing throughout the last 18 months, and we've met from time to time on the issue, and they have been taking management actions to deal with that shortfall. They have been having to dip into their ending balance, which they had originally executed such that they would have about 4 to 6 months of operating expenses at the end of the biennium, and they have had to use some of those amounts to stay current with the workload. However, they also have held some positions vacant, and as you note in the governor's budget, the current legislatively approved budget has 63.75 FTE. The governor's budget has 60.75. That includes the elimination of the deputy position for the agency. So they are assiduously, I believe, working to deal with those shortfalls. Number of factors they believe have led to the reduction in the number of new licensees and renewals. If you'll recall, they implemented a business competency test in July of 2000. There was a large bulge of new licenses that came forward just before that was implemented. And the pace of new licensure now is somewhere between 300 and 350 licenses a month. And renewal rates, the agency will talk about more as they look at get into the discussion that you had raised to me earlier about the fee increase that they have in their budget. Again, with the shortfall, the governor's budget is predicated on a fee increase, and the agency is prepared to speak with you in more detail about that today. They're not directly affected by the state's overall general fund shortfall because they are an all other funded agency. And the governor's budget is a 4% increase over 2001-03, but a large element of that is inflation, priceless adjustments, and roll-up of the employee compensation that was the limitation that was increased during one of the special sessions. Briefly, the package would generate, with the fee increase that they are anticipating at this time, would generate approximately $5.2 million, 4.2 of which would be used to restore positions. They had also had some reclassification of positions that review had taken place during the interim that the Department of Administrative Services Human Resource Services Division had approved reclassifications of several positions, and those reclasses are contained in the budget.
Representative Johnson is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Adrian, I just wanted to make sure I understood you. You said $5.2 million in fee increases, and how much of that would deal with reclasses?
Only a small portion, Representative Johnson. There is a package of $28,000 approximately for the reclasses.
I did misunderstand you, and that's good. I thought you said that a million of it was reclasses.
I'm sorry. If I said that, I may have. I took cough syrup this morning.
Maybe I needed to take
cough syrup.
Okay. Thank you.
And the agency, as you may know, is located at the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs building, and There had been early discussions that the rate would be going up. The agency at this time understands that at least for this for the fiscal year 2003-04, that will stay at its current rate, but that there may be movement upward for the second fiscal year. It's uncertain at this time. There were also several budget notes last session. The agency has been frequently in front of interim legislative committees, and they have done their homework, Mr. Chair. I'd like to report for the record that they have continued to meet on a regular basis to review their information technology needs. They continue to have their what they call the CC bits, and I'll use that acronym because it's a useful little thing. But it's the board's information technology steering committee, and it's made up of members of the board and the staff at the agency, but they also include me on legislative fiscal office on the mailing list so that I'm aware of what they're doing, and to the extent that I can attend, I do. Last session, last interim, that was not at all, but they do send out the agenda and the minutes and so forth so that I know what they're examining, and I have an opportunity and have done so to email to them comments. They have also, so they complied with all of the information technology budget notes by bringing reports to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management Technology. One of the budget notes had allowed them to come back and seek additional expenditure limitation for workstation replacement. They have not done that during the interim. They have included a package in their budget to take care of some limited amount of workstation replacement. They had also had a budget note to continue looking at performance measures. They have, again, met with the Progress Board staff and have gone through that process with their board and the agency staff, and have refined further their performance measures in relation to the ongoing development and refinement of their business plan. The last budget note had requested that Department of Administrative Services review their information systems unit positions. That review did take place. And although the Department of Administrative Services determined that reclassifications of some positions was appropriate, the agency, again, because of budget issues, determined that they would reassign duties for the balance of the biennium rather than reclassify those positions. With that, I have concluded my initial comments.
Thank you very much, Adrian. Other questions, Adrian? Let's see. Ms. Brewster, it's nice to have you here. Thank you for coming today. Are you going to make this presentation?
Well, I'm not going to start it off. I'm going to be handling some of the parts you've expressed concern about, the education, dispute resolution, customer service. But we're going to start with Craig and let him give you the overview, and then we can go into my part, or we can start with me, whatever you like. Chair Butler.
Representative Johnson, what would you like to do?
It seems to me that some of the questions that you've raised speak to how one would look at the presentation of the agency, and I'd almost rather get to the specifics and let the specifics frame the overview.
Okay. Senator Devlin, with the indulgence of the members, and because Craig has been here a couple of times before, can we suspend the normal formalities of our rules, and if you have questions, just go ahead and ask the questions. But so the questions won't have to be directed through the chair to Craig. Will that be okay, Craig?
It'll be very good. Thank
okay,
you.
And that way we'll go into a kind of a much more informal arrangement. Can you keep track of us, Karen?
I'll try.
Okay. So if we can go about that, why don't you jump right in, if you would, please, Ms. Brewster, and let's do that, and let's see if we can, because I was 15 minutes late. No, wait a minute. It was Senator Devlin we were waiting for.
Yeah, we were both here right now.
Yeah, that's right. We were changing that story. We were going to stick by that newsroom. Okay, please go ahead.
All right, for the record, I'm Sydney Brewster. I'm board chair and public member of the board, and I have been for approximately 8 years. And since your questions focused in Adrian's presentation on contractor education, I guess I'll start there. And I would welcome your questions as I go along rather than having me just spew forth information.
And so you may receive them from any member of the, including Adrian. We'll let her go ahead, and if she's got questions, they don't have to be directed to the chair. We'll make this much more informal and see if it moves along more quickly.
Well, I'm going to try to answer your question that you started us off with, Chair Butler, and that was about whether things are available online and whether they're available around the state. I want to just say to you that since the inception of the education program, which was about 10 years ago, a little bit more like 12, right, that has been a concern of the agency. And we have, I think, done very well with providing the education through home study at the community colleges throughout the state and other locations, providing it in a number of different formats for different learning styles. We have tapes, both audio and visual, and also workbooks and home studies as well as live classes.
So in large measure, Ms. Brewster, then folks from Lakeview can become licensed contractors without having to drive back and forth to Salem more than how many times?
Absolutely correct. They may not have to drive to Salem at all.
A single time?
Right, because The testing that we provide as part of the education, which is new for us, the last 3 years approximately, we have provided the testing at, kind of interestingly, H&R Block locations through our testing providers so that no one is going to have to drive from Madras over to Salem or Lakeview or Pendleton to get licensed in this state. And so just to get rid of that concern.
Where'd you come across that idea? That's a great idea. It really is.
Honestly, I mean, don't know. I think it came from our testing provider. Craig, why don't you cover that for
us? It's a great idea.
Chair Butler and members of the committee, Craig Smith. In fact, it did come from our testing provider, our current one, and it did seem to make all kinds of sense to use those.
They can proctor the examinations. The offices are normally easily accessible.
Exactly.
More accessible than our community colleges, Craig?
I would say so.
Okay. I'd like to see them, obviously, at the community colleges, but those may not be as close. And, again, Lakeview would have to either go to Ontario or to Klamath Falls. So,
well, I can tell you that our testing contract is out for review at the current time. We have RFPs out, and the new testing apparent winner will be looking at online testing. As a matter of fact, it's part of the, not the mandatory, but it's one of the things that would be permissible under the contract.
That's a great idea. Can we apply that to all licenses in the state, except for medical examiners, I guess? It is a good idea. They should be well administered there. Please.
Anyway, continuing on, in our packet, I'm starting on page 27. I think that our little pie chart is self-explanatory. Craig and I were both pleasantly surprised to see that now 11% of our licensees have taken the test. And so it is, I think, a worthwhile program. We've had great success with our testing provider. One of the things that Adrian alluded to is that we've worked very hard on our performance measures. Having started out my relationship with the board as an education provider, the education program is very dear to my heart, and we struggled since the inception of the program to come up with a performance measure that could try to tell us that we were doing what we were supposed to do. The legislature wanted us to keep contractors in business longer to protect consumers and for their own sake and for the industry. We couldn't come up with anything until we did this time, which is the percentage of CCB tested contractors that file bankruptcy. It may not seem like the very best performance measure, but we think that that shows that they are employing better business practices, that the education that we're providing and the testing are working. And even though the numbers are very preliminary, and we will have much better numbers now that we have this in place, it looks like we're seeing a downward trend, and you can see the chart on page 28 demonstrates that to date. Did you want to say something, Craig? I hear him breathing.
Mr. Chair, that would be their separate packet that was put at your place.
So if you go to page 28 in that packet, Chair Butler, members of the committee, you can see
those declining numbers in bankruptcy filings?
Tested contractors that filed bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
Subsequent to taking the test?
Yes. And I think Craig had something he wanted to amplify on that. Did you want to say something?
Well, I wanted to make sure the committee had the document in front of them that we were referring to, so they had the right pages. But, of course, we've only been doing this for a couple of years now. What we have now is about 10% of the current licensed contractors have taken the test. The issue, of course, is does taking the test do anything to improve the product that they delivered? We chose this as a way to try to determine whether or not that's performing a proper outcome.
I'm just trying to understand the correlation between the number of gross bankruptcy filings total and economic conditions and things that are well beyond any measure of your testing. A huge downturn in the economy could very adversely affect the number of the whole universe of bankruptcy filings, and I'm just trying to understand how you factor in those issues beyond your ability to control that are cyclic with business.
Representative Johnson, let me piggyback on that, and let me see if I can put some sideboards on that. If you were to test those that, if you were to say, here's our entire population, the population is 100, and here's the list of those, or here's this group that took the test and those that haven't taken the test, and there's a higher percentage of bankruptcies amongst those percentage, not in brute numbers, but in percentage, and those that have not taken the test, then would it show that those that have taken the test are better business people? Is that what
you're... Yeah, that's kind of what I'm getting at.
If I may, I think that's an excellent comparison that you've suggested, Representative Butler.
Have you
really
done that?
Is.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And if you look at page number 28, and you look at the chart on page 28, and the chart line item number 3 is the percentage of non-tested contractors that have filed bankruptcy.
That's the dotted line?
Mm. No, I'm looking actually not...
down below.
The chart below the graph.
I'm sorry.
And we're looking at number 3 there. There is the percentage of non-tested contractors that have filed bankruptcy. And you can see what those are. It's roughly half of a percent. And then the following is the percent of tested contractors that have filed bankruptcy. And you can see the difference.
Maybe you could help me understand something, Craig. The number of CCB licensees total, and then A, are they not required to pass the test?
Yes.
They're grandfathered.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And so these are folks that at some point in time when you instituted the test, you said these 43,000 get a King's X. They don't have to come in.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and then 1,700 have passed the test since the test. I'm just trying to understand how to read this chart.
What I've got here, Representative Butler and Representative Johnlett, what I've got here is actually 3 fiscal years of data. The first fiscal year is July 2000, and that shows the information for that year. And in fact, at that preliminary point, we only had 1,700 contractors that had taken the test. If you go over to the far right-hand column, that shows 5 months' worth of data ending November 2002 for the latest. That's the latest data we have, and shows the number of contractors in total, the number that have not taken the test, and of course we're up to about 5,000 now in effective November that have taken the test, and then the relative data for that.
And you've still got, although there's been a decline, I can't think of the word, you've gone from 43,000 to through attrition to 36,000 in your grandfathered. And out of your total universe of 40,000 or so contractors, the percentage is that the lion's share of them have never been tested and 5,000 have.
That's correct.
I mean, what I'm trying to get at, I guess, is, and forgive a kind of blunt force question, but in looking around at the plethora of issues that the legislature is dealing with, have you guys ever given any thought to someplace else where you could go be, where this function, where you're really looking out after 5,000 folks, and you've got this kind of pool behind you where there may be malfeasers, and you're focused on 5,000 people, have you ever looked at what if we didn't exist, what would be the way that we could keep track of those 5,000 to protect the consumers?
Representative
You can address Butler. Directly as Representative Johnson.
It occurs to me every day what would happen if the Construction Contractors Board didn't exist. And I think the state would go on swimmingly. There's no question that there was building activity and consumers that were satisfied prior to 1971 when the board was created. The question is, does this somehow add some value to both the economic as well as to consumer satisfaction? I think that the answer is yes. But a fair analysis would have to indicate that, yes, you could do away with the Construction Contractors Board and things would still work. Now, I haven't given further thought to, well, how else would we do it other than the possibility of some private association. Oregon State Bar, of course, regulates lawyers and does that without too much state input.
I'm just trying to think, and forgive me for asking a question that's reflective probably of how little I know about what you really do, but I'm just trying to think of if you did testing at the community colleges, you had a test, correct to 100 kind of test that you did online. Failure to pass the test yielded some really meaty sanctions, and that was that. Now, that's a grossly oversimplified version of the world, but I'm just trying to figure out when you're looking to add back 29 positions and you've got deputies and you've got directors and a giant bureaucracy to take care of ostensibly 5,000 people, even though I'll give you credit for the fact the number's growing.
Representative Johnson, we actually take care of all 42,000. The 5,000 just has to do with the education program, and that takes up about 5% or less of the agency's budget.
Well, if I may, it also the education program has included a substantially higher number than those 5,000. The education program has been in place since 91. Therefore, it's just a testing program that we're looking at, which is only a couple of years old.
So I guess my last question, at the risk of beating this to death, is out of your universe of miscreants, you're trying to see how many of them come out of this grandfathered that haven't taken the test, are not required to participate in continuing education versus your 5,000 that have stepped up and taken the business practices test.
Representative Johnson, the purpose of this performance measure was to try to provide some outcome for the testing program at all. There were those who think that testing of contractors is an awful good idea. And in fact, the legislature decided that's what you wanted to do. The question is, how do you determine whether or not testing gives any value? And so what we did was take a look at those tested contractors, see if they're causing problems compared to the universe of contractors that aren't tested, and put this in this chart to try to demonstrate that.
Other than bankruptcies, is there any other performance measure benchmark on them?
Well, as we've thought often, if anybody has a better idea for us, we would love to hear it because we have wrestled this horse for so many years.
Did you have any? I think you were working on something.
Well, the place where I connect with your agency mostly is in folks that call me and have had some activity occur that has had a bad outcome. And I'm just trying to figure out if I'm somebody who is making arrangements to do business with a contractor, what is it that you do that prevents this bad outcome, and how is it that so many of the bad outcomes that I hear about have no resolution to them? They don't get fixed through mediation. They don't. And at the end of the day, you've got somebody with a condemned sign nailed on their house. They're out $45,000. And I'm just trying to figure out how you not have that happen.
Well, perhaps the thing that we should do then, Representative Johnson, is move off of education to our licensing, customer service, and enforcement, because I think that's really where you're going. And, Craig, maybe you'd like to start off with this, and then I'll jump in on the customer service licensing part, and you can talk about enforcement.
I think there's three other parts of the agency that help address that problem. The first part is customer outreach or customer service. This is where the agency tries to reach out to consumers and give them some tools to hire contractors that aren't going to cause them problems. Heretofore, we haven't had much of a budget to do that, but we struggle to do so. We reach out by home shows. We have a website. We do a variety of speeches, that sort of thing. We've developed brochures to try to describe to consumers what their rights and responsibilities are. The government's not going to take care of them cradle to grave, but if they do a few simple steps, make sure that contractor is licensed. Make sure that a contractor has some credentials. If they're going to do concrete work, what kind of credentials do they have? And also, let them know that if they do have a problem, we do have a dispute resolution service available. Now, it's true that not every problem gets resolved, but over of all the contractors that we have, we receive about 8,000 to 9,000 complaints of biennium.
Let me just ask just quickly, in that regard, Craig, of those 8,000 to 9,000, can you identify amongst the percentage-wise amongst those that have taken the exam? Versus those that have not taken the exam, would that be?
We could certainly do that.
Thank you. That finally got it where I am. Of the ones that you're testing, how do you assure that you got a good outcome? And I think Chair Butler's right on it.
Yeah, the complaint. Can you get us that information or get us some feedback?
Yes.
On that?
Yes, I can. Okay.
If I may, just not to find a point on this, but. There are so many other factors, too, that come into the complaint process, including work practices and so forth. What we test for in the state of Oregon, unlike many other states, is strictly laws and business practices. So one of the ways we developed that particular bankruptcy performance measure was because it directly addresses laws and business practices experience rather than work person-like conduct. So just to make that distinction, because it is different. In many states, they test on code and ability to do the actual work.
And their work practices are lousy. Eventually, they're going to go bankrupt, aren't they?
Well, I think that's true. And many states have as many as 25 tests that they provide for various types of trades. So we are a little bit different in the way that we go about this.
And on the web, Representative Patrick had a question about the web and what is published on the web.
I was wondering on licenses that are revoked or people that have violated, you guys suspend or do whatever. Is all that information available if I'm somebody from the general public?
Representative Patrick, we don't list all the people that we've taken the license away from. We list all the people that we have any kind of a history on, whether we've licensed them or not. We have that available by phone number, last name, and license number. Very easy to use. If a person inputs any of that data and gets the right person, then it lists whether or not that person has a license today, whether it's been revoked, suspended, and what kind of a claims history that individual has.
Are there confidentiality problems that would keep you from having the list of bad actors?
No. No, there's not. As a matter of fact, we are right now, I don't think I've shared this with Sydney, but we are looking at putting together what happens oftentimes is we can take a license away and we can issue a civil penalty. And that stops people from working 99% of the time. But we're working right now with a problem in the Sherwood area where the individual has run up several fines. We took their license away 5 months ago, yet they continue to work without a license, take money, and not do the work. Now, we've got to get that person's picture out. We've done a variety of things to get to the media and also use local law enforcement, but the idea that we have is to take those special kind of offenders and put their name, even if we have their picture, to display prominently on the website so that individuals who are working clearly without a license and are not paying attention to licensing laws are displayed so the public can see them.
That just seems like a no-brainer.
But that's on the web. I can go look up Craig Smith if you had been a licensed contractor. I can look up your whole history.
Can you get his picture?
Complaints and
can't get the picture today.
Oh, okay.
But we're hoping that perhaps we'll have that in the future.
Because it's on OLC or not OLCC, but DMV has it.
DMV
right?
Would certainly have the picture of everybody who has a driver's license.
You exchange that information? Excuse me, I represented Devlin, or Senator Devlin actually was there that me, but go ahead.
Craig would be younger and more suave looking.
Yeah,
yeah.
Indeed.
High school
class isn't there anymore.
Mr. Chairman, remember, we do have a bill in the building to change it so that in voters' pamphlets we can use a picture that's up to 4 years old.
I would like to add that we do publish our newsletter, which has all of our disciplinary actions listed there, and the newsletter is now available online, I believe. And so that also is mailed out, and that is available then to the general public.
And you send it to us, too.
Yes.
Yeah, we get it. Send it an email.
On a serious note, I haven't actually read the statute for Construction Contractors Board, but at least my understanding of it is that you are not the sole remedy available to a consumer. They obviously still have a remedy, a private remedy outside if they're not satisfied with the decision that you've made. That's true, correct.
That's correct, sir.
The reason I brought that up is because I want to compare this in terms of the Department of Justice and their Consumer Protection Division. There, they have so many cases, they don't pursue every case. They don't pursue but a small number of the cases, only when there's a pattern and only in respect to their limited number of resources. Well, I would like a better result from the Construction Contractors Board. At least in this case, they mostly pursue every case that comes forward, and in a perfect world, they'd resolve every case. But unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
Okay, we were continuing on. We got down to the dispute resolution. Is that where we got to, Ms. Brewster? Is that?
Yes, I believe so. We were also going to talk about customer service, but I think that we can just jump into the dispute resolution because that's something else that I feel very strongly about, and it dovetails on what Senator Devlin was saying. Which page am I on, Craig? Here's page tracker.
We want to go to dispute resolution. On our handout, it's on page number 36.
Thanks.
As you warm up on this, our ability to get the photograph of offenders who work without a license has been hampered in the past in getting those pictures from DMV.
Is there a bill in the building right now to do something about that?
No.
I have a bill in the building to do something with regard to DMV. I have a bill in the building right now to Construction Contractors Board is one of those older boards that has an application on the application that has a Social Security number, and everybody else is going around saying, no, you can't get Social Security numbers. Well, it just so happened that everybody that's applied for licenses through the CCB have gone ahead and written down a Social Security number, is my understanding. And so I hope that you won't feel badly when you see the Department of Revenue, and I think, Craig, you've probably already been in touch with the Department of Revenue relative to these issues, because I'm saying, wait a minute, there's 40,000 contractors out there. I'd just like to know that when they're filing their applications to be renewed as contractors, that they're able to tell us that they've filed a tax return, and that's fairly easily matched. You take two databases and you just match them for numbers. And so I finally got the director of the Department of Revenue to say that she was going to work with you and maybe put that together, and there is a piece of legislation now that says that we're going to, on those privileged licenses, which we have in the state of Oregon, that we're going to start gathering some of that information, and we're going to start asking them, are you filing your tax returns? And I need some input here. If this is the wrong direction, more of the police state that we're going to, I'm just saying if you're going to apply for a license within the state of Oregon, if you have any obligation to file an income tax return to the state of Oregon, we want you to say, yes, we're current, or no, we're not current. And this is a way then to make sure that when they file and give us a Social Security number, that they know that we are looking at their income tax return as well.
Representative Butler, it fits right in with the regulatory scheme that has been developed over the last 30 years, which is to make sure that if you are registered or licensed as a contractor in Oregon, you're taking care of your financial responsibilities. And this is one that just hasn't...
Well, this is a big one.
Yep.
I mean, if I see contractors go out for any single reason greater than that of failure to pay their merchandise for their suppliers, it's for failure to have some payment due and made timely to one of the tax collection agencies. They'll take care of you before they take care of most anybody else, but then, they can't work at all without their license renewed. So I hope that's not too Orwellian for my colleagues here, but...
I'm worried about your representative.
I can see you sweating there, Representative Patrick. But I guess the concern that I've got is that... maybe that bill should be amplified so that you should be able to access the DMV so that you could download any driver's license. Because you probably ask, if you're asking for Social Security number, probably asking for driver's license number, Oregon driver's license number as well. If you're not, you should be.
We have.
We do.
In fact, we do. And the one thing that would help us get the photographs through is the ability to go directly to DMV and ask for those photographs. The thing that's preventing us from that is a status of law enforcement agency that that status we've talked about as a legislative concept from time to time. That's not before you this session, but in future sessions, should you deem that appropriate, that would assist us in our ability to identify offenders.
I think either Senator Devlin or Representative Patrick or Representative Johnson will probably be on the JLCIMT next round, and if that's the case, then we probably ought to make sure that that gets thrown in the hamper. Would you make sure that that's on a some sort of a follow-up note, please, Adrian, that we begin the process of doing that, because I think that's all, and I think that's an excellent idea with regard to all of these privileged licenses that are issued by you folks and other folks. It just so happens Construction Contractor Board is the largest single, outside of driver's license, I think, is the largest single board offering privileged licenses in the state, I would think. Is that right, Craig?
I don't know the statistics on that. We do have 42,000 at 46 at one point.
Mr. Chair, I think the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission also has a very large portfolio of licensees.
Right.
But it's probably in the same ballpark.
But that's something that we need to add, and maybe Dallas can help us add that to the Joint Legislative Information Management Technology Committee. So that's an issue, that we're getting driver's license numbers from all of those folks, so that when we have legislation that's in place to allow us to do it, that DMV can, that you just cross-match your privilege licenses, and all of a sudden you have pictures of all of those folks, and I'm going to guess that some of those agencies are just going to scream bloody murder about the fact that they've got pictures of people without their burkas on, so... Sorry about that.
That's only the female contractors,
right?
Just checking.
Absolutely.
Please.
One of the things I wanted to just add on to what you're saying is that we do have a membership in the National Association of State Contractor Licensing Agencies, and I serve on the board of that organization on behalf of the Oregon Contractors Board, and we do have a database through NASCLA. About half of the states license or register their contractors, which I guess I should say only half, because I think it's disturbing that there are about 24 states out there that don't do anything. But we do share data on revocations and enforcement actions with those organizations, and I think that that will only increase our ability to track folks along with what the suggestions that committee members have made so far. I'm not sure whether we're on customer service or dispute resolution, but I think we're on dispute resolution, so that's where I'm going to go. You had asked some questions about that for some statistics, Representative Butler, and I want to just go through this just a little bit. We do handle our statutory authority is in 701-139, and we can handle claims against any contractor through our board. I want to start by saying, so I don't miss the opportunity to say this, that this part of our operations is even more critical now in this fiscal crisis. As an attorney practicing mostly in Marion County, but also in Lynn and other counties around the state, we are facing a major crisis in the judicial system because of lack of funding. In Marion County, we are having to close the courts on Friday to all public business. We are going to have a backlog that we probably won't see the end of, at least according to our presiding here, Judge Lipscomb. We're probably going to be looking at the ramifications of this problem for 10 years. This program that we have will keep approximately 8,000 claims out of the civil court system per biennium. When you recognize that we are funded without general fund dollars, when you look at the budget crisis in the courts, this is a very cost-effective way to deal with some of Representative Johnson's concerns about getting redress for consumers and for contractors with other contractors. We've got all our statistics for you within our handout. I'm starting on page 36. Some of the unique factors of our dispute resolution process are bulleted there. As I work with the National Association of State Contractor Licensing Agencies, I am constantly reminded of how proud I am of this program and how proud Oregon should be of this program. It is unique, it's idiosyncratic, and it's one that a lot of other states would like to replicate.
Are we being overly burdened by this kind of regulation, though, Ms. Brewster? Is that, have we heard that in relationship to other states?
No.
Okay. Everybody loves it. Most everybody.
Everybody loves it, and they wish that they could institute it because it's not a burden, it's a benefit.
But when you say everybody loves it, you're talking about other states, other state agencies.
It's the resolution process.
Okay.
And
so you've...
If I'm tracking with what you're saying.
Okay, you should
ask your question again to make sure I heard it.
So everybody that's used the central hearings panel, both sides are coming away happy.
No, I would say that both sides are coming away somewhat unhappy, which means we're doing our job.
Okay.
I think it's rather like a civil court system in that there's a winner and a loser, and somebody's usually unhappy with us.
But as an agency, you're happy.
As an agency, we're happy, and I think that, by and large, other states envy us because this is a benefit to consumers
and that
we can provide at very, very low cost.
The charge is reasonable.
Right now, we don't have a charge, but we're thinking of doing that. Craig, you want to talk about that?
I saw you wince, Greg.
I think Representative Butler might be referring to the hearings officer panel call.
Oh, okay. All right. I was on a little different tack.
Yeah, beg your pardon.
Why don't you talk about the hearings officer panel, Craig, if you'd like to do that?
Let me just say that what happens is that we have a dispute resolution program wherein 90% of the disputes are resolved without a hearing. That's the key figure. 90% of those 9,000 are resolved either at the beginning stages or at the job site through some form of settlement. Hearings officer panel is not involved with that. That's one of the reasons why both industry and consumers appreciate this product. And of the 10% or so that go to hearings officer panel, it's fair to say that when we lost our hearings officer several years ago, we went to the panel, and the record indicates that the agency, that wasn't their first choice. We would have preferred to have our people in-house. That was not the will of the legislature or the governor, and so we are doing it differently today. The hearings officer panel at the beginning, it was difficult for them to get off to a good start. There were some growing pains. There were significant delays. I can tell you that we've worked with the chief hearings officer regarding our concerns because that did lengthen the process of adjudication in our process quite a bit, and we kept detailed statistics, and we argued with him to try to improve that. He has been responsive, and he has improved that. The costs have not come down. I think it's fair to say that the costs are more. And again, I support the governor and the legislative decision to have a panel. If you decided to go the different direction, we would have an in-house panel that would be, in our estimation, equally as service-oriented.
And cost, Craig?
It's possible that the cost would be slightly less.
Slightly less under a non-hearing panel arrangement. But you only go to the hearings panel after you attended the dispute resolution.
After we've exhausted all of the rest of the process, that's correct.
And what happens is the agency, in most cases, if the resolves 90% of the cases, if that doesn't work, then a person can request a hearing. They request a hearing about 10% of the time, and then those matters go to a hearing. After the hearings panel has heard those cases, they can appeal back to the board, and that appeal becomes before a subcommittee of the board of about 3 people.
Okay. Do we have please proceed, Ms. Brewster, if you were going to continue on there.
I guess I would just call your attention to the figures on page 37. I don't want to dwell on this too much. Our claims are broken down here for you. Homeowners represent approximately 54% of those that are bringing claims, and those are the ones most likely that would need to access the circuit court system in order to get redress if they didn't have our dispute resolution process available. Contractors and material suppliers are approximately 43%, and employees are about 3%. I've already covered the fact that this relieves a tremendous burden on the court system. It is affordable for complainants. The average cost to file a claim in circuit court around the state is around $170, $180. Here in Marion, it's $167, so that is a savings to the consumer and also a more rapid process. And our goal is to process those claims rapidly and as expeditiously as possible. And we have a wonderful team of on-site investigators that go out, and that's our initial volley. And many, I forget the percentages, like 80% that are settled at that point.
Well, what happens is, like I say, about 90% before it goes to a hearing.
And many of those are settled at the on-site investigation, and our investigators make a report, and often that's all it takes.
And there's further numbers and information for you on page 38. Without a hearing, 45%, early resolution, 45%, and then the claims that are appealed are a slim 1%, and the hearing claims are 9%. There's a pie chart that graphically demonstrates that for you on page 38. The trend is up for the average days it takes to issue a final claim order, but many of those circumstances are partly that we've had staff challenges and other challenges that affect that. You can look at the factors affecting the service.
What's your goal? It's gone from 157 days.
Target is 120 days or less.
Okay.
For that. And as you already alluded to, some of the factors affecting our service are the transition to the hearings officer panel. That has
caused some of that. Are they slower in hearing those?
Well, I think it's a transition to the panel, and somewhat, yes. Yes.
Representative Butler, initially they were slow, very, very slow. And I can report to you in the last 6 months that have greatly increased, decreased, and they're quicker, much quicker now.
Okay, they're going to have hearings on the permanent implementation of that hearings officer panel. Are you folks going to testify?
Don't plan on testifying, sir.
So even though it isn't really according to your best judgment that it's doing the very best that it could be doing, rather than reach the wrath of somebody whose favorite bill it might be, you're going to stay away from it?
Representative Butler, my board hasn't directed me to go one direction or another. If they did direct me to testify on that, I would testify that that's a policy choice. It's a policy choice is whether or not you want to have a central hearings officer panel. And again, if I was in the legislature, I probably wouldn't agree with that. But they haven't asked my opinion yet.
Okay. Well, the question is, it was put in for 2 years beginning in 99 and then extended an additional 2 years. Now they would like to go ahead and make it permanent. And my concern is that I haven't had a lot of people tell me that it's much faster, that it's much cheaper. But, necessarily that the people are better prepared when they have the hearings. I mean, that they're more skilled in that particular industry. There are a few that have had greater complaints than others. Sounds like you're slightly negative, but not enough so that it's off the charts at this particular
point. Well, if I may, as a public member of the policy board and just as a citizen...
You're not afraid of the politics.
A citizen of the state of Oregon, I have to say that we were very proud of the program that we developed in-house. We instituted hiring our ALJs rather than independent contractors, and we developed a training program that we felt was more than adequate. And the quality of the ALJs that we have, one of whom is now our probate judge here in Marion County, was very laudable.
And that was cheaper than what you were assessed for the hearings officer panel?
I think the statistic would indicate it's slightly cheaper. The advantage to the panel is the perception by some that there is no impropriety.
One tiny step more removed.
Right.
Correct.
Right. And that's the degree to how much that affects the public is a decision the legislature needs to make.
So 90% of the cases are resolved early on or without any hearing, and then 9% go to some kind of a hearing, and then only 1% go to a hearings officer panel, or is that the 1%
goes
to court?
No, that's the number that are appealed to the Court of Appeals after they've been processed by the hearings officer panel.
That's strictly at the Court of Appeals, not...
Correct.
Not the,
well, that's the Appeals Committee.
Oh, the Appeals Committee, okay.
Chair Brewster is at a disadvantage because I prepared these documents and haven't fully briefed her on this. But the 1% includes all matters that... There are actually 10% that go to hearing. After the hearing, 1% of those, or approximately 10% of the matters that go to the hearing, are ultimately appealed to the board, and a few of those go about probably 12 a year go to the Court of Appeals.
Mm-hmm.
Court of Appeals.
They don't go through the circuit court system.
Okay.
Some of the other factors that we've alluded to is the complexity of the cases. And the fact that the economy, this recession we're in, has created cash flow problems for contractors, so we're seeing more claims.
I noticed that you've had a lot of charges against bonds. You keep track of that.
Absolutely.
And that's $5 million. What's that in relationship to prior years?
It's in the ballpark, not too much different. Typically,
even with the economy?
Even with the economy. We actually have awards that are less. We're down around $10 million in awards this biennium compared to $12 million previous, and even larger than that two bienniums ago.
It's interesting. That's kind of counterintuitive, isn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is. We like to think it's the stellar job that the agency's doing.
Great. Cool. Go for it. I take credit.
One of our other performance measures is on page 40, and that's the percent of licensed contractors operating in Oregon that fail to pay in full their final dispute resolution orders for damages. And the trend is down. Our dispute resolution program, along with so many of our other programs, is designed to make contractors accountable for their business practices, as we've already discussed, and to ensure that their debts are paid and consumers aren't left with the kind of damages that Representative Johnson discussed earlier. And our target is 0.50% of those. The next performance measure is listed on page 41. And again, I'm not covering all of the numbers that we have for you, but if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to ask Craig or I.
I might just interrupt because this is on target with what Representative Butler was asking. And page number 41, we have statistics that give both the satisfaction level of the dispute resolution
yes.
program in total and the satisfaction level with the hearings officer panel. Every time we have a matter that has a final order, we send out a questionnaire, whether there's a hearing or not. We receive those questionnaires, and then we track the satisfaction level of the people. And on this chart on 41, it's divided into two sections with a thick line. Right above the thick line, you'll see the satisfaction level of the overall process over the last two quarters, which is above 70%, 72 and 74%. Interestingly, for the hearings officer panel, during that same period of time, for matters that went to hearing, 70% satisfaction level and 78.
So it's actually going up then?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. I think we've already covered revenue sources, but it's licensee fees, as you know. We have discussed and proposed a claim fee. The claims do have a cost. We are in a budget crunch. Many other dispute resolution processes, including at the municipal and county levels around the state and within our circuit court system, charge a substantial fee for resolving disputes. Frequently at the local government level, you'll see charges between $300 and $600 to file an appeal with, say, a city or a county government.
Loser pay on that? Or?
Pardon me?
Is a loser pay?
It depends on the municipality, the local government. Often some of the fee is refunded. Sometimes it is a non-refundable fee, and sometimes both sides bear the cost depending on how it was spent.
What's your proposal?
Our proposal is a $50 fee for processing a dispute. We would also implement a waiver similar to the waivers that you find in circuit court for indigent folks, the folks that can't afford those fees.
And you can do that by rule?
Yes,
okay.
I believe so.
Right.
And if you were to do that, anyone who comes in and pays a $50 fee and you find out that they were just slam dunk absolutely correct and it's eventually resolved against the contractor, is that fee then refunded and charged the contractor?
This is the way it would work. We'd receive the claim. We'd review it for jurisdiction. If we had jurisdiction and could process the claim, we'd send the claimant a invoice saying, if you want us to process this, it would cost you $50. In receipt of that $50, we'd begin the alternative dispute resolution process, which includes mediation. And one of the things the mediators would be coached to do is, look, we got a problem here at the homeowner's home. The homeowner has paid $50 for this process. This is now negotiable between the builder and the consumer. If the builder wishes to pay that money back, if it's going to be a cash settlement, that's fine if the consumer is willing to take it. If they don't negotiate something and it goes to hearing, it would be in rule that the hearings officer could award the damages to the consumer directly from the builder. In that way, you should understand that the agency would keep the $50, but the builder would pay the consumer the $50.
Senator Devlin, what's your feel on that? Does that sound reasonable that somebody, a homeowner who had a complaint, ought to pay $50 have it or have it at least considered for resolution?
Mr. Chairman, it may not be reasonable, but the alternative to pay the cost and actually doing it would either to be for the contractors to bear more of the cost of the complaints, which might be a reasonable solution, or us to provide general funds, which might be a reasonable solution. You know, in some years in the past, but I don't think it's probably a reasonable solution in this session.
Okay.
If I may, too, to amplify on what Senator Devlin has said, we focus a lot on contractors as miscreants, and I heard Representative Johnson say that, and I have to admit that the hairs on the back of my neck went up a little bit, because by and large, our contractors in the state are darn good, and I'm very proud of our industry. And it's a very small percentage of contractors that create the problems. Mm-hmm. And I know that this will shock everyone on this committee, but occasionally homeowners file frivolous claims. And
Representative Patrick,
I've never seen anyone file a frivolous claim.
So I knew that would shock everyone.
And to further amplify that, what we often find with matters that are before us is that it's an honest dispute. There's
what
a disagreement.
What do the other agencies do? What do the other agencies do? Realtors?
Yeah, what do the realtors do on the fee? Do they pay a fee? How do when there's complaints? Do you know?
They
don't really do the same kind of process we do.
Right. There should be a distinction made between filing a complaint alleging a law violation, in which there would be no fee with CCB, and there's no fee for any regulatory agency that I'm aware.
It's just quality workmanship and
right.
Completion of
this dispute resolution program, which mirrors the court system, really.
Okay. It's two-party claims. I think we've pretty much covered the dispute resolution program. Unless you have other questions, it makes sense to go right into the enforcement program.
I don't want to run out of time here before we get some folks that have signed up to come in and spend a little time with us here with some testimony. We've got some Urban Remodelers Association. Let's see, Stephen Cafori and Linda Joplin.
All right.
There's another Linda in the room. Okay,
Linda.
All right.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Stephen Cafori. Thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning. I'm here today representing the Oregon Remodelers Association, which is the professional association of remodeling contractors and suppliers, subcontractors. We, as an organization, were helpful and instrumental in getting the Construction Contractors Board established in the first place as an alternative dispute resolution because we have problems with people who file complaints against us, and we have sometimes they're wrong and sometimes we're wrong. But to have an alternative dispute resolution function in government, that it doesn't require us to go to the circuit court and take all the time. And
so it's working well for you. Mm-hmm.
It's working very well for us. We're very supportive. We're supportive of the budget. We're supportive of the increase in the fee. For a minor increase in fee, we still feel we come out way ahead in the process.
I agree with what Stephen's saying, that our this is a great boon to the contractors, and for those of us, for those people who say that this may be skewed, I would just say that I think it's in all of our interests, not only the industry but the CCB, to see that we have happy consumers out there and that they get what they pay for.
Any questions for these folks from the Oregon Remodelers Association? Thank you very much for
your
testimony. And Linda T, is that right? Oh, okay. All right. All right. Any other public testimony that didn't get signed up here? Thank you very much for your input. I just didn't want to. I didn't want you to have come all this way today to just sit here. But you were probably enjoying the testimony and the accolades and praises that they were giving anyway. Okay, we can go ahead and have Ms. Brewster and Mr. Craig Smith come back forward and Satish.
Representative Butler and members of the committee.
Let's talk about fees if we could. We were moving into that fee area. Let's find out what your overall, and let's see, we've got everything is based upon expenditure limitation of what we're doing, so any fees that are raised or that we have to confirm under what? Senate Bill 93? All right. We'll have to be
the Mr. Chair, the validation of fees that are imposed by an agency administratively during this during the interim then are ratified by action of the legislature in regular session.
Okay.
I don't believe that this wouldn't be the same issue if the budget is adopted with a fee increase incorporated in it.
Okay. So you're saying it does not take legislative action outside of Ways and Means?
Correct. Because that is the legislative action is authorizing
the fee increase. So the fee increase is what we're looking at?
Mr. Chair, that's where I'll defer to Mr. Smith to go through. Just for the record, for the members, what I just distributed to you is an analysis that Representative Butler had asked the agency to provide to show the effect under current fee structures. Starting with their projected ending balance for the 0103 biennium and what would happen to their cash flow and at what point would their funds be exhausted. And Mr. Smith will go into more detail about the materials that are attached that have a variety of models associated to show you that.
Okay. I'm used to these being in more of a graph form, showing us, you know, how much money you come up to and from your relicensing and those kinds of things, but as long as Representative Hobson declared that I was more lineal than some other folks, and I don't understand that. I really don't. Accountants don't think lineally, do they? No. Okay, please, go ahead.
Oh, there is a chart, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, but that is that of the average balance?
No,
that's
I'm
the number of contracts.
That's the licensing.
Oh, wait a minute. Maybe
those are licensing levels, and that would...
Renewals?
Relate to the cash flow.
Oh, okay.
Representative Butler, if I only knew you were graph-oriented, we would have got that. We have some rather interesting graphs. We can share those with you at a later time.
Yeah, just your cash graph. And that, for some reason, we did that last year, we did the session before, and then all of a sudden I don't see them anymore. Maybe, I don't know. Go ahead.
What I can tell you about the cash in the bank is that we had a high point before our testing period of about a little over $4 million. That represented 8 months operating capital or so. It wasn't really analyzed as well as we could have, but we started to lose money maybe 3 years ago, something like that. We started to spend more money than we were taking in, and it was apparent, very apparent when the biennium began, that we needed to take a close look at this, and we started doing a variety of analysis to try to figure out what's going on. Of course, we discovered that the fee necessary to fund the agency is predicated upon how much you want to spend, how much you want to have in the bank at all times, and then what rate the receipts are coming in. The receipts come in based upon what new contractors choose to join and at what rate those existing contractors that expire choose to re-up or renew. And until the time of the test, we were looking at a rate that went up and down somewhere between 50 and 75%, historically about 70% renewal rate. And we were looking at 500 new contractors every month. When we put together the budget, we used these figures, or at least that was in the background of the minds of the people who chose to try to come up with how much revenue we'd have, and we missed the mark. In fact, instead of 500 new contractors, and the best thing to show you what happened here is the graph that is the last on the pages here that you just got.
Page number five.
Yeah, page number five. You can see what happened here. We were right around 500, and we spiked in 2000.
And the reason for that was?
People trying to beat the test.
Okay.
And we thought we'd come back quickly to 500, but it never came back. But interestingly, we've had a kind of a counterbalance. What used to be a 70% renewal rate has started to creep up, and it's gone up in the last few months to close to 80%. And over the last 24 or during the month of this biennium, it's close to 78.
77.5.
Okay. So why is that? Well, probably because people don't want to lose their license and have to take the test. We receive a lot of folks calling saying, what do I have to do to put my license on hold? and we do have an inactive status now because, frankly, they want to avoid that test. So we're having more people renew.
That's really that tough, okay.
You know, 83% of the people that take the test ultimately pass it, but 17% take it time after time after time and fail. The test is not particularly easy. It's a test, I think, that is right where you want it to be. It's in the ballpark, but most people want to avoid tests. And there's a cost involved, the education as well as the test.
How many pass the test first time?
53%
first time?
Yes.
Could be a little too hard then. Is it a nationwide test, or this is one that's just administered by Oregon?
This is Oregon's test.
You know, I'm just going to
guess, but I think that the passage rate on the bar exam is better than that on the first test, isn't it, Rob? And I think the passage rate on the CPA exam is better than that nationwide. Maybe you ought to look at that first time score, Craig, and wonder whether or not you're building an exclusionary industry on behalf of the grandfathered folks.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I might just also point out that the current testing program is a closed book variety, and I believe the agency has recently adopted an administrative rule to make that an open book test. But coincidentally, the test itself is being revised. So there will be a variable there that will be uncertain how to tell what the effect of having an open book test is without a comparison between the nature of the tests.
Mr. Chair, I've had people call me about how tough the contractor's test is too, but by the same token, when I've asked that, you and I went to a lot of schooling to take the CPA exam and the bar exam, and I had a pre-bar course for a very intense, I think it was 6 weeks. But, when I've asked those people, well, what kind of intensive training? So
they just take it cold?
I think a lot of people take it cold or read the pre-exam book, and that's all they kind of do. So I don't know how you determine test validity at this point in time, but maybe that would be something if you're redesigning the test already that it would be good. I think.
Well, let me ask this: How many passed the 75% on the driver's exam first time? I mean, there's no real schooling for that, but.
Well, and Mr. Chair, too, the agency's keeping track of test results by the source of the.
The
provider, so that whether it's a home-based study or whether somebody's taken through a community college or through some other study provider, so they've got that kind of data as well.
What does it show us?
Well, what it shows is there's not a significant difference between a live class and a home study class. We thought there would be.
So a live and a home study both 53% passage.
Pretty close.
Huh.
Not identical correlation.
Right, but
which was very surprising.
And is it consistent? One does better than the other, but only by 1 or 2% each time.
I would say that's
does
correct.
Better the home school or the
actually the home study has been doing a little bit better, which was very surprising.
That is surprising, isn't it? But less discipline or more discipline required.
Disappointing to me, quite frankly, but true, because I would think the opportunity to have an interchange with an instructor would provide a better result, but it doesn't seem to be.
Representative Johnson, what we're discovering is that those folks that are taking this exam, ultimately 83%, is that what you said, Craig?
That's correct.
Ultimately 83% pass it, but on first time, the failure rate is substantial. Only 53% pass on the first time, and of the professional examinations, that's tougher than the professional examination. So the concern is maybe it's a little too tough, because I can't imagine on the driver's examination on the written examination at 53%.
If I can provide you just a little bit of input, our testing program is very new. In many of the other states where they test, although their tests aren't comparable to ours, it's kind of an apples and oranges example, but folks are used to the testing. They know how difficult it is. In California, for example, it's very, very rigorous. And folks prepare, as Representative Patrick said, folks prepare. I think here they're not used to it, so they're going to take a flyer at the exam without much effort. And we may see that change with the open book test, as Adrian said.
There are also some fairly interesting test models. I come from an aviation background, and we required recurrency of our pilots all the time, and it was a factor of how good our insurance policies were. And Bell Helicopter Testron came out with a very interesting test that was a correct to 100 test. And it had a tendency to reinforce those test answers, and the student taking it does their own test to 100 or correct to 100. And so you take the test the first time, winnow out that field of questions you don't know. There's some additional study on them. Then you take the test again. If the idea of the test is to try to winnow out people who are never going to make the grade, then that would be one kind of testing. If the idea is to reinforce in the test takers certain rules, it always reinforced in my mind, at least when I would take these correct to 100 tests, the one or two questions that I would miss. It would be cause to study those with greater intensity, and you learned something from that. So I think there's testing styles, how people take tests, and the kind of tests that they're able to take, and what your goal is. If your goal is to have half the people flunk, then you write a really rigorous test and half the people flunk. But it sounds to me like you just let them take it again and again and again until they correct. If you were doing it online, you'd do one of these snappy correct to 100. They self-learn while they're correcting to 100, and I might refer you to Bell Helicopter Textron for the model to do it.
We've certainly talked to a lot of psychometricians and various testing entities to learn about this as we've been going through the process, and I have to say that I wish they would do the bar exam like that. So it had something to do with the practice of law rather than nothing to do with the practice of law.
Okay, we're trying to comment on that.
Well, I mean, I was just commenting to the chair on the side that, I mean, the CPA exam is done in specific parts, like
in part
test
practice,
100.
Audit, the theory, and law.
And, mm-hmm. and, you know, the law exams pass-fail. I would tend to agree with you to some degree.
We have tried to make our tests line up directly with the education program and the mandates that have been set out there so that the modules have questions very relevant to what we're trying to teach. And I think that's an excellent suggestion. We're always looking for suggestions on how to make this relevant.
Are there limits to the number of times you can take it? Because what is it with the bar? I forget.
I don't know. I passed the first time.
I threw you that much ball so you could get it on the record. But if you've got somebody that is like on their 88th iteration of the test, somebody goes and counsels with them and says maybe another line of work would be a good thing for you to consider.
Mr. Johnson, what I can tell you is that the rules currently state that the person could take the test three times in a row. They've got to pay the fee, so they've got that problem. $50 currently is the fee that the provider charges to take the test, so there's that barrier. But I should tell you that I recently received a call from an individual who had work lined up, hadn't worked for a long time, had their bond, had their insurance, had everything, and they had a job to do the next day, and called me and said, can you do something about allowing me to take the test? I need to take it a fourth time. I'd like to take it today. And the rules don't allow that. The rules require a waiting period. Now, the board considers that from time to time. That's a rule that the agency has. If you think that's something that we should reconsider, we're happy to do so.
Well, I try to make it as flexible. In this economy, I try to make it as flexible as you possibly could relative to allowing folks to take it to stay in employment.
Conversely, Mr. Chair, to schedule work the afternoon of the test hoping like hell you're going to pass it strikes me as perhaps a little short-sighted and maybe indicative of exactly the business practices that you want to root out. just a thought.
For the record, sir, I'd like to correct. I did say 53% first-time passage. The correct passage rate is 51%.
51%, so lesser still. Okay. That's a pretty rigorous test. And relative then to the fees, the fees would be exhausted by February of 2004 on the projected CCB case reserve balance.
Yes, that's true, sir. If we end up with a cash balance at the end of the biennium, as indicated in that particular column, that is the cash balance that we predicted about 16 months ago or so, or actually about a year ago. This month, we did a lot of things to try to save money, okay? We've been doing a lot to try to save money because we haven't had the receipts coming in. And so when we project right now, our savings efforts have been fairly... have worked fairly well. Right now, we are looking at the far right-hand column, and we'd end up with an ending balance at the end of this biennium of $2.2 million. Therefore, when we run the string out, we wouldn't be out of money until September of 2004.
Craig, one thing I've got that is of concern to me is that the contractor, according to the information that Adrian's provided us, we went from nearly 44,000 down to about 41 and change. That's a reduction of several percentage points, and yet I don't, we've got two employees, a reduction of two employees. When we're dropping, let's say that we're dropping 6% or 7% of the total number of people that we're serving out there, for whatever reason, and we're only going to drop our employee ratio by a couple of employees, is that really the direction that the contractors in the state would like us to go to continue to build the organization?
The contractors want us to be prudent with their money, but they want us to provide the services that they're asking for in a timely manner. At one point, we were 90 days out in terms of renewing a license. That's when we were fully staffed at 68 people or so.
But now we've got all this computer hardware and software to take care of us, right?
That's right, and we have reduced staff. We're at now proposed at 60.75. But the thing that one should remember, I would hope, is that the licensing, the renewals, has been automated pretty well. It does not necessarily drive the amount of disputes or the amount of enforcement actions. That uses a whole lot more money. And I have a graph in here, I'm desperately trying to find it, to show you those ratios. If I can find it, I will. Somebody whisper in my ear where they are.
So the fees that we're looking at, the fee increases, let's find those, let's see if we can put our finger on those in the various areas that you're asking for a recommendation of fee increases. Craig, can we do that?
Fee increase that we would be looking at, the governor's recommended budget figures a fee increase at $320.
Where's that delineated in the package, in your package or in our package here?
We have some discussion on the fee increase at the end of the package. It is on page number 57.
The end of the book, to get the story here. Okay, so projected it goes from 295 to 320?
Right now we have a stair-step fee structure that doesn't make a lot of sense. Something different for renewals, the new license, something different for one kind of contractor to another contractor. It ranges between $160 and $225 per two-year period. The governor's budget is predicated on a fee of $320 flat. There are substantially more. Maybe two-thirds of the contractors are registered and paid a higher fee of $225 currently. So we're looking at a fee increase there of a little less than $100 per biennium or less than $50 per year.
So the current fee ranges from $160 to $225, and the proposal is to bring it up to $320 flat. That would be a 100% increase for those that are paying $160.
That's correct.
Can't imagine that they're going to be terribly happy about that.
I should tell you, sir, that those people paying that amount have been subsidized by people paying more. Limited contractors, some of the contractors that get that category, it costs the same amount to process their licenses, costs the same amount to do the enforcement action. As a matter of fact, it's the smaller contractors, frankly, that we have more problems with in some regard. And when it comes to dispute resolution, again, there's no difference between the contractors. So to have
the 160 are the small single resident contractors, and the 225 have been the industrial users.
Actually, what we have is a fee for contractors that perform primary contractor work or general contractor work, all structures, that'd be commercial and residential. Most contractors are registered that way.
Do we have that somewhere in the book here, in the presentation?
You want to know the percentages?
Well, yeah, I'd like to know. I'd like to have the number of people that are paying the $120, $160, the number of people that are paying anywhere in between, and those at the top end, so that I've got an accounting of the 42,000 representative package.
Was any notification sent out to those people that you have in your in your database as to the hearing today and the fee, raising the fee?
Well, yeah, Representative Patrick, what we've done is for the last year, We have talked with all of the industry groups. I'm talking about Associated General Contractors.
It's in your monthly newsletter to the contractor?
Yes.
The proposal of fee increases.
Indicating that that a fee increase would be necessary.
What kind of response are you getting, Craig?
I've received one complaint. I've received no complaints on fee increases. I received one complaint from a material supplier indicating that it would be unreasonable to have a fee to file a claim.
That's the $50 fee that you're...
Yes.
Correct. Interestingly, they pay nothing towards the dispute resolution process today. I'm talking about material suppliers.
But would your response to that material supplier be, but if you win the case, chances are you might get paid and the $50 back?
That's exactly right. If it went to a hearing, that would be the end result.
Okay.
Just to point out that even at the 100% level, as you pointed out, because I had some queasiness about that too, it really is only coffee money per month. And to maintain our current levels of service when we've already really done everything that we could do to cut costs is very minimal. And for the contractors to be able to access the services that they're used to and consumers as well, it's pretty darn reasonable.
I'd really be careful characterizing it as coffee money per month in this economy, particularly all the coffee money that I use.
Mr. Chair, you had asked a question about the relative proportion of the license categories in it. The footer on page one of the agency's cash analysis flowchart, it shows that... I found it here a moment ago. Approximately two-thirds of licenses are licensed as general, all, or specialty, all, which are the licensed at $195 fee.
At present, so.
Currently, yes.
General, all, specialty, all.
Are at the $195.
What does that mean?
General is a general contractor. All means both residential and commercial.
Okay. And specialty?
That's the kind of contractor who would do just one kind of work, like a concrete or framing or floor covering. So you think
same price? Same price if you're a general that do everything.
Yes.
And same price for the specialist that doesn't do everything.
Right. I tell you the truth. I can't understand what the rationale was to charge a different price.
Yeah.
Clearly, there's different volumes here. You can make an argument that if a contractor is doing a lot more volume, there's more risk. And
the license different? Is the examination different?
No.
So if I'm going to apply for a specialty to just do side or just do drywalling or putting up sides, I guess they call it framing or something like that, I might as well just go ahead and ask for a general. The fee was the same.
Correct.
What would be different, however, is your insurance cost
and
your bond. And right now, particularly, you would not want to be a general because the insurance costs are driving generals out of the business, the small ones. We're seeing from 100 to 500% increase in premiums, and folks just can't afford to stand.
How much could that be? That's a few hundred. That's coffee money. Excuse me.
You're going to rub that in forever. I can feel it.
I got a lot of coffee. And maybe it's been such an interesting last biennium that I'm now having some flashes and recollections of people who talked to me. I did have some constituents with issues. They are alarm companies with low voltage. They put in low voltage kind of wires and those kinds of things, you know, like SOS, Sonatrol, you know, all the general alarm companies. You know, they were concerned too that why their people they have to be general contractors. Their people have to be, you know, have to have general contractors, and really, they're running low voltage wire.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, I think also there's an issue about the category of electrical licensing that they have to have, and there are some bills that have been introduced that deal with a very odd number of voltage items.
Line. I think I have a bill to that extent.
Maybe perhaps you do. Yes.
And I have a bill for telephone installers, too.
All right. Well, maybe we'll deal
perhaps
with that.
Perhaps the electrical law needs to be reviewed.
Well, I'm curious that may be the case.
Are they going to summarize that for us, Adrian? Homes and all the
specialty
I did that one time with Sunset Review of the Building Codes Division, and I
don't want to go there again.
So then you would be the perfect person, Adrian.
I want to go there. Board of Boiler Rules, I think, is the kicker. Mr. Chair, yes.
I was going to say another point of interest might be on page 57 of our handout. We did a comparison. If a person was in the residential home building industry, what kind of a fee would you have to pay in different states, particularly different states that might have the same kind of dispute resolution process and fraud investigation that we do? And first point is, I think we've had a slight increase in the terms of the renewal rates and the amount of new contractors. And today, if you authorized, if the Assembly authorized a budget in accordance with the recommended governor's budget, I believe that we could have a fee increase July 1st of only $295 instead of $320, and it would take care of both funding the entire spending authority as well as bringing the cash reserve back to an acceptable level.
Craig, I'm on your list here, and I'm going to be most sensitive to what state in addition to Oregon. It's going to be Idaho, and they're not on your list, and the reason is?
Idaho doesn't have state licensing.
Yeah, see, and that's, so we've got some that have a goose egg and some that go up to $900, and so I guess my concern is, you know, what's the average of that,
Representative Patridge? Well, I guess I'd like to go back to, we kind of got off track with the other piece. My concern is by licensing category, if we are going to do something, and I know that we'll have fiscal impacts and those kinds of things on the particular bills, but are there areas that the board has looked to, or is there legislation that the board has proposed to exempt or feel like their authority may be a bit overreaching, whether it be like telephone, low voltage, those kinds of things? You know, because that all fits into how much you're going to ask for licensing, what the ongoing piece is going to be, all those kinds of issues. And so I'm wondering, or if that's nominal.
I'm not sure what nominal would be, but I can tell you that we don't have any legislation to exempt additional contractors. However, we are working with Senator Harper on legislation that hit the floor, and is going to have a hearing next week that would exempt a certain category of contractor. This is the category of contractor that, interestingly enough, builds no buildings and does no work on real estate, but because of the broad nature of the definition of a contractor, requires licensure with our agency, and that's basically the type of people that provide temporary workers. And because they provide temporary workers to contractors who are, in most cases, exempt contractors, they don't have workers' comp insurance, that worker is actually working for the temp service, not the contractor per se. So the temp service is providing all of the workers' comp coverage and is really the employer. And because the worker is doing construction work and that is the employer, that business is defined as a contractor according to statute. Senator Harper's bill would exempt those people. There's probably 25 of those to 50 of those in the state. There's some concern on the board that then there'll be no licensure, and some of those businesses may not carry proper workers' comp. Some general contractors may hire those individuals, and then they'll be responsible for the injured worker, and maybe they'll be the injured workers because there is no workers' comp, nobody looking over those shoulders. There may be some problems. But that bill will be before committee next week.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, though, does the construction contractors board, though, go look at the, I mean, you've created this test, and you have a definition of the contractors. And has there been any rationalization between really what's on the test and the nature and scope of the work that the particular individuals are providing? And do some of those individuals, maybe like the low voltage people or the telephone people, has the board taken a position on whether it's appropriate or not to do those? I mean, a lot of the test is probably structural kinds of things. Business practices.
It's strictly laws and business practices affecting contractors. And so, in a sense, it's suitable for any business person in the state, quite frankly. Some of it is very relevant to laws specific to the industry.
Roll it into accounts,
EPA regulations and things that don't so much affect a retailer, for example, but they are laws and business practices.
Perhaps under an armed guard, you could bring Representative Patrick and I a copy of the test, if you would, please. I'd like to look at it. Maybe Senator Devlin would like to look at it, too. I'd like to look at the test and see whether or not, it may be something that may not even be relevant to some of the kinds of directions that we want to go, but I would like to take a look at it personally, and I think that would be an appropriate thing for us to do, particularly where you only have 51% passage rate.
We can probably figure that out with the test.
Sure. Okay. We could mix up our... We could take it anonymously.
You don't
run any cram schools or anything like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right.
I did run the numbers real quickly just to answer your question. Including zero for Idaho, the average is 400 on the states that we've listed for.
And you should know that although Idaho doesn't have a state regulation, they have what Oregon used to have, which is some cities have licensing requirements and bonding and so forth.
And as I say, that's where I'm most sensitive because the cost of construction in Mountaineer County versus the cost of construction in Payette or Washington County, Idaho, or Ada County or Canyon County, Idaho, it is roughly 50% higher per square foot in Mountaineer County as a result of everything that we go through, including that includes the issues of the Davis-Bacon, those kinds of things with regard to public facilities. So it's a major issue. And I assume that what you're doing is you're averaging in Arizona.
Mm-hmm. Well, I averaged all of those plus put in zero for Idaho and left ours out because ours is just proposed at this time.
Okay. Adrian, we're going to run out of time, as you'd indicated that we would. We were originally scheduled for 2 days, and we, because of the earlier interruptions this past week, give us a 30,000-foot level of what we have to cover before we would even sit down to discuss a work session with these folks.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you for that. I'll try to spring to action here. There are a number of proposals before the legislature that have significant policy ramifications and hence a budget influence. There is at least one proposal to create the agency as a semi-private agency. It's my understanding that may be broadened, that the concept of semi-privatization may be broadened to a number of agencies. The Ways and Means Committee as a whole needs to stay informed on how those developments may come forward because that clearly drives the agency's budgets. Our experience last session with the semi-privatization of the Landscape Contractors Board, which had been staffed by Construction Contractors Board, can give us at least a framework model of how to develop a budget for an agency moving out on their own. There are other legislative proposals that are in substantive committees as referred to the one that would allow them to charge a fee that's in proportion or relation to circuit court filing fees for filing claims and the processes that the agency would go through to implement that would have a budget effect. The fees that would be derived from that bill are not constructed into the budget. So that bill needs to come to Ways and Means to take a look at what the revenue expenditure impact would be there for limitation purposes. As I had discussed with you, Mr. Chair, and I've had the conversation with Craig Smith, and when Robin Lamont was doing the budget, and she and I had also met with Ms. Brewster at one time, and we had indicated that one of our concerns was that the external forces which create enactments that have a cumulative effect on the agency may have the effect of impairing the ability of the agency to find where its balance point is, and my concern in that regard is higher this session because of its revenue shortfalls. So the cumulative effect of industries and organizations and parties who feel that the agency should be doing more or should be doing something differently could have an effect that tips them over the edge.
notwithstanding any decision on the legislature's part to raise, allow them to raise fees. For instance, last session there was a proposal that brought forward a program which they have implemented that would require them, does require them to oversee the secondary contractors in public works projects. They knew that that would be a workload. They didn't know what it was going to be, but at this point it is more than they anticipated, and that may be driving some of their resource uses that they were simply not relying on, and there is no fee associated with that function.
What is it? Can you specify a little bit?
Perhaps Craig could elaborate.
It's got to do with public works projects, so there's two issues. One has to do with what's known in the industry as prompt pay, and this is where a contractor would provide some work on a public works project. Subs would do their thing, the suppliers would do theirs, do it in a good workmanlike manner. The general gets paid, and then for whatever reason doesn't pay the sub or supplier in a timely manner. That's prompt pay, and there's a legislation will require the agency to accept those complaints, investigate them, and then there are various sanctions for the contractor if it's found that they haven't paid in a timely manner.
And what kind of resources is that taking up?
We're measuring those. One of our compliance officers is dedicated to that. We're measuring their time on an hourly basis to see what that uses. It's, I can tell you that it started off very slow, and we're receiving now complaints. I can't hear you a volume, maybe two or three or four a month. But they're timely to investigate. I mean, they're costly to investigate.
But all those subs are paying. I mean, they have to be contractors too.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. To the general. Right. So they're paying in, they're benefiting from the services.
Correct.
So that would be rolled up as part of the fee.
Correct.
Okay.
The other issue has to do with
I can understand. I'm sure the subs drove the legislation, so I can understand why.
State agencies exempt from that.
I'm sorry?
Are state agencies exempt from that?
No, the agencies are not exempt from that. The agencies, though, wouldn't be caught in that trap because they pay the general, but since the general paying the first-tier subcontractor.
Liabilities between the sub and the general.
I think right now of ODOT not having paid their contractors, it'd be interesting to see, because I've got contractors in my district that can't get paid for 120 days.
No, but that's between the state agency and the... That would be the state agency and the general. But if they had the asphalt people and the other subs down there, it would be the sub versus the general.
There's also legislation last session that is somewhat difficult to explain. It has to do with improper substitution of a first-tier subcontractor. This is not my area of expertise, but essentially when a person bids on a project for public works, they may put down the subs that they're going to do, not necessarily. If they do put down the sub they're going to use, then if they substitute and it's not one of four or five or ten different good reasons according to statute, that's called improper substitution, and there's a penalty imposed for that. It's fairly...
Craig, where's that legislation at?
It passed last session. We're dealing with that now.
Right. It has not generated a whole lot of work. What's happened is I think the general contractors don't improper substitute. Rather, they pay attention to the law. And so it's been kind of self-enforcing.
Before we get back together, and we will get back together, I would like to have a lineal graph on these money issues based upon current cash over balances, if we could. And then I would like to have just a little bit better feel for the actual licensure and all of the classes and categories that you're talking about here. And then, finally, I'd like to have some kind of input from the folks. I'd like you to, Craig, make sure that there's a notification that goes out to your folks in the very next newsletter that, you know, that this is, that these are the proposals, that they know that those are the proposals, and that you'd like to solicit comments in that regard, because, and let them know that stay tuned, same time, same place, to figure out if they want to come forward and express their great support or their lack thereof. I guess I'm concerned, and you know, when we're using a state as far away as Arizona as our comparison of $895, and that they have the highest rates of any Western state that I can see, and that's the justification. I'm a little concerned to say, you know, maybe we ought to get a little more efficiency or a little less workload responsibility in the agency. I mean, I don't see the commensurate reduction in number of staff in Oregon based upon the reduction in workload, and yet through all this automation and high technology, we're not gaining the efficiencies that we could have obtained, unless, of course, we, and I'm sure that's right, we heap more and more responsibility on them. If that's the case, maybe we better start coming back and making a more work-friendly state.
Okay.
Adrian, perhaps you can coordinate an opportunity for us to get together privately with Craig and you and I, and we can just go through some of this information beforehand, giving me a little bit better feel for what we're actually going to be looking at. In relationship to right, in relationship to what's on the table right now, what's on our plate right now, and what may be coming on our menu relative to the other bills that are out there in the legislature as we get a little bit closer. Senator, any comments as we wind these down? I would appreciate any input, and particularly any of your constituent input. Just forward that on to me, and make sure that we get that. In the blend here, because you brought up some excellent points with regard to your low voltage and some of those things, Representative Patrick. And I am anxious about these kinds of increases of fees and times of peril with regard to our economy. I think it may be counterproductive in some respects.
Mr. Chair, did you want to hear from Budget and Management Division?
No, Satish will just give you a call on the phone. Oh, wait a minute. Maybe he should. Yeah, for the benefit of them. Satish, let's see, you have 3 minutes. You can do it next.
I have a real quick overview, Mr. Chair, of the governor's budget.
Which one do you have there? One of these, this one right here?
Yes, you can have a copy of my handout.
Okay, go ahead, Satish.
The governor's budget consists, for the construction contractors board, consists of $12.1 million total funds. This is a 3.8% increase from the 2001-2003 legislatively approved budget to the fifth special session. Basically, what the budget does is that the most important issue, I think, is the fee increase. It is dependent on the change of the fee structure as well as increases in fees. And a little bit about the fee increases, to give you an example and to answer some of your questions. The current, under the current structure, the initial licensing fee for all structure contractors is $225, and for residential contractors is $190. The renewal fee for the all structure contractors is $190, and for the residential contractors is $160. So all of this would change to a flat fee of $320. When the budget was developed, we had extensive discussions with the agency, because yes, we also realized that this was a big increase, but this was approved by the board, and the board did talk with the stakeholders, and the stakeholders, I think they wanted a fee increase instead of decreasing services. And based on what Craig has testified earlier, what I heard is that this $320 could be reduced to $295 based on some new information that the agency has after the governor's budget was developed. And the agency could still maintain the same level of operations. What the budget does, it reduces the agency's requested operating expenditures, including two positions, to minimize the requested fee increase. The positions that have been eliminated includes the deputy administrator position of the agency, as well as an office specialist 2 position. And both of these are vacant positions right now. The budget provides additional funding for rent. During the 2001-2003 legislatively approved budget, the agency was not provided full funding for rent. So this time, there's some additional expenditure limited provided besides the 5.3% inflation factor that's generally provided for rent in non-state buildings. And also the budget replaces some old computer stations. There's $72,000 of expenditure limitation provided for that. And lastly, it reclassifies 6 positions in the enforcement section. 5 of these positions have been reclassified because the Department of Administrative Services came up with a new classification for compliant workers. So unless you have any other questions,
I had seen that rent figure, and we talked briefly about rent, and I thought maybe I'm just not understanding what happened to that rent factor.
Mr. Chair, in fact, what happened is in 2001, 2003, legislative approved budget, the agency's actual rent cost was $669,787. In their budget, they only provided the $535,330 for rent, and so the agency had to absorb the cost through other expenditure line items. What this budget does is it provides a little over $600,000 so that the agency can fully pay, fully cover the rent expenditure. The agency rents its space from the Department of Veterans Affairs, so that's what it does. Under the essential packages, there's just a 5.3% inflation factor for rent.
Okay.
And since in the legislatively approved budget for the current biennium, the rent wasn't fully covered, that's why we have a policy package.
Okay. Other questions for Satish? Hearing seeing none, thank you very much for coming. Thank you, Adrian. We'll come back to this again. Yes, Mr. Corey.
Stephen Corey, Urban Remodeling Association. I just want to bring one thing to the attention of the chair. This issue of a rate increase, a fee increase, is not a new concept to the remodelers or the home builders or the contractors, associate general contractors or the floor contractors. There's a very, very wide variety of folks out there who belong to all these different professional industry associations. Craig has let us know 6 months, 9 months ago. We've had this in our newsletters. We've had this in our membership meetings. There is knowledge out there in the industry. This is not something that for the first time it's being brought here. Oh, my gosh, how do people feel about this? Generally, the consent, we have heard virtually no opposition because we know what the needs of this organization are. And the communication from Craig to the members of our organizations directly through his newsletters and also through our organizational newsletters.
And that's throughout all the other industry newsletters that you're aware of.
Absolutely.
Not just the remodeling.
No, through the Floor Covering Association and the Plumbers Associations and there's
maybe you could gather some of those things together, Stephen, if you could for me, and I'd like to take a look at them.
Yeah, I'd be happy.
So I've got to have a better level. I mean, if I had a $160 bill every 2 years and it was going to $320, I'd almost, and today's economy, I'd almost think I was being gouged. But that doesn't address the period of time that I may have been paying $160 either.
And the other issue, Mr. Chair, is that if you're doing $2 million worth of business a year, that's a really small increase. It's tax deductible, so it only costs you half of that. And the chances of being caught up in a court case where somebody is suing you and you have to go hire an attorney and spend months preparing and hours of time in a courtroom, this is an enormous, tremendous bargain. So I will be happy to get, I wish that the people were here, a lot of them are here in the building, I'll get the other lobbyists to present.
If you could bring me some industry newsletters from the past 8 months, 9 months, while this has been on discussion,
okay,
I would appreciate it so that I have a solid feel and recognize that I'm coming from just a little bit different mindset. I just happen to live next to one of those states where the average is, between zero and 160, the average is $80. But, I'm going from zero to 320, the average goes up considerably. So I just like to know be aware of the fact that everybody is really, really pleased to see this going up because they're going to save so much as a result of the industry's arbitration and mediation program.
And also, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your concern, and I realize that's what your job is here, and I respect that that you're following your job. I just wanted to give you also information that part of the agreement that has been made with the CCB by a lot of the industry organizations is that in trade-off for increasing the fees, we'll get this $50 fee, a filing fee, that will help us prevent, we think, some frivolous suits or frivolous complaints by homeowners who are unhappy because they didn't like the color red that their house was painted.
I think that's fair.
Thank you
very much, Stephen. With that, we'll go ahead and close. Thank you very much. Thank you.